Right, hello everybody, and welcome to the first episode of The Coach's Corner. I'm your host, Matt Fryer, and if you didn't know, this podcast is aimed to help everybody get their golfing fix and also help us improve along the way. Whilst listening, we're going to be talking to coaches, tour players, anyone from the golfing space, all to try and wheedle out some little bits of information that are going to help us get a little bit better at the game we all love. And today we're going to be joined by not only my father, but also fellow of the PGA, Adrian Fryer. So firstly, Adrian, welcome to the show.
Morning.
How are you finding the whole lockdown situation? Is it keeping you sane, or are you going a little bit crazy at the moment?
Very frustrating, I would have to say. Yeah, it's tough, I think, for most people, you know, and obviously some people get into their fitness and others are studying and so on. But when you're used to being busy like me every day, and don't get me wrong, I'm busy myself. I think I've watched every seminar and podcast and everything, and I've done a lot of walking and so on. But so, to a degree, we might be drowning in information at the moment, but we're lacking the practical experience. We all want to get out and do it and just play golf again and hit balls. I want to coach and, you know, help people get better. So that's the
That's it. You know,
we're all in it together.
We are missing that, and like you say, there's that that element of a lot of information out there. So it is a, you know, a positive to come out of it, that there's a lot of great guys out there who probably people wouldn't get the time to hear from them or ask questions to them, but they're, you know, the lockdown's allowing them to put some of their views out there.
Yeah, I think it's some fantastic coaches, and there's obviously some fantastic information out there now. You know, that we're living in a world where technology, you know, going back, I'm a dinosaur, but, you know, going back to the 70s, 80s or whatever, there was two or three programs of golf. We'd watch Pro Celebrity Golf on TV with Johnny Miller or Sandy Lyle or Tony Jacklin and what have you. That was your golf fix, of course. The Open to come on every July, and that was the highlight, or the Masters. You got, you know, two or three holes, and that was it. Now we've got free access to everything we could possibly want to know about golf.
Exactly. So let's for the listeners there at home, let's get a little bit into you. Let's get stuck into the meat of your career and where you started and where you've got to today, and how you're finding the whole golfing space. So, talk us through it. Where did it all start? Obviously, I know, being your son, but let the listeners know where you started to play as an amateur golfer, how you grew to become a professional, and what made you choose coaching.
It depends how long you've got here, but the kind of abbreviated version, I grew up in Manchester Worsley. I live right by a golf course, so I was very lucky. And I used to, my best pal's mum had said, why don't you go out and do something with your time in the Easter holidays or what have you? So we ended up joining the golf club. My parents didn't play, but I was a pitch shot from the golf course. So I used to run home from school, jump over the fence and play golf every day. And when I say every day, I mean every day. 365 days in a year, I played or went hit balls or did something. So I kind of got semi-obsessed with it. Loved the isolation, loved the concept of man against himself, you against yourself. I wouldn't say necessarily a big team sports player. So from there, you know, played amateur golf, got down, you know, 2-3 handicap, reasonable player. But I caddied for some good players. I was very lucky. I caddied a particularly good player, and you knew him, Harry Owen. Harry, you know, sadly passed away now, but Harry was a scratch player, a member at Royal Birkdale, and me, and Worsley. So I learnt a lot from Harry, and that was kind of exciting times. And then assistant pros job, 1978-ish, something like that, in Prestwich, Manchester. Then I was very lucky, 1979, to go and work for Alex Roberts. Alex was, again, coming to the end of his retirement at Ringway. But Alex had played in the Open and had played with Bobby Locke and been around in the kind of Henry Cotton era. So he taught me a lot, as well as making clubs, you know,
and
also.
And going into the professional game, when you decided to turn pro, was it a case that you'd decided that you were going to become a coach? That's what you wanted to spend your life doing? Or was it the aspiration of most players, or, you know, good golfers at the time, to get on tour, be a player and see what happens, and that didn't manifest and you fell into coaching? Or how did...
Yeah, I would say, like a lot of coaches, I mean, you want to be the best player. I wanted to play. You'd had dreams of being a tour player. And you wanted to be the best player you could. I wasn't probably class myself as the most talented sportsman, but my work rate was hard. But I, you know, in those days it was a different kind of world than it is now. We're young men and transitioning into, say, amateur golf and the level of competition now, amateur golf level, and that transition into pro ranks. In our day, you would go and be an assistant pro at a local golf club. So that's what I ended up doing, and you'd play regional tournaments. And obviously the good players stuck their heads up and then progressed from the region and to the tour. And some of them, like Langer and Woosnam and all these guys, went to the tour 5 or 6, 7 times before they got the tour card. I wasn't good enough to do that. I was a respectable player, but I kind of still am. Still love playing. I'd play golf every day and hit balls every day if I could. But you get drawn. I got into assistant pros and then a club pro, you know.
And did you, any success in any events at all? Did you ever manage the Open qualifying route or anything?
No, I've been to final qualifying for the Open, I think 1983 or 4, when Watson won, and I played in the final qualifying at West Lancs, and kind of the usual stuff like that. But I wouldn't class myself as a player of great note. We won the, you know, we used to Lions stuff, won the Dunham Forest Trophy, all those sorts of things. And I try and be, you know, I want to be a respectable player. I still have pride in the way I play. I want to knock it around in low par or sub par, and still do to this day. But your priorities change. I went from being assistant pro there at Ringway, and then I got my first club pros job in 1984. And then, unfortunately, you're beholden to the bank manager and the mortgage. And then you came along, and then...
And that's when your life got better.
Yeah, exactly. That's when I was, you know, everything was rosy. And then 3 other daughters, and before you know it, you're in the mortgage trap and earning money. So you're playing, unless you're really obviously very good, takes a back seat. So I had the responsibilities of a club job and a very busy job at the time. And your career path goes that way, which was great. They were great days. I can't... You know, fantastic times.
And when you got into the coaching, was it something that straight away you felt an affinity to? You really enjoyed the process of watching people get better and finding more information out on the golf swing, finding trends and seeing how people take on board the information? Was it something that you felt very comfortable in doing?
Yeah, I was passionate. I always am still passionate now, kind of 40 years on or whatever, nearly 50 years. But you've got to want to help people. You've got to enjoy helping people. You've got to enjoy people. You know, it's the old Butch Harmon story. He talked about one of his brothers. He said he's in the people business but doesn't like people. and that's one of his many.
I know a few of those.
But you've got to like people and you've got to like helping people. That's you've got to have empathy, where maybe as a tour player that might be slightly different. You know, there's been all sorts of profiles going on tour players over the years of whether they're egotistical or selfish or obsessive or what have you, and there's nothing wrong with that. To be the best in from a competitive environment, you need some of those qualities, traits or what have you. To coach, you have to have a bit of empathy. You have to understand that that person is trying their best and wants to do what you like them to do, but sometimes it's not that easy. And hopefully you develop the skills and the communication skills to paint a picture or help them do it. I mean, I was lucky. My other boss, Nick Ryan at Ringway, Nick was very much ahead of the curve, a county coach, a good player himself, had played for the county. And he at the time, and this is, you know, we're going back to the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, subscribed to publications from America. And I was reading these and being exposed to people who were in their infancy. Hank Haney, Jim McLean, Mike Hebron, all the guys, you know, Chuck Cook, Bob Toski, Martin Hall, all these guys who are now world-class teachers. They were forging their path. As well as I was lucky to spend a little bit of time with John Jacobs. So I kind of got the appetite, and I was very interested in what they were doing, and also interested in talking to my fellow pros about the coaching industry and the way we learn, and what are they doing over there, and are they better than us, and why aren't we doing this? So, you know, and then you learn on the job. If you're going to be any good, you've got to do I've done millions of lessons, and, you know, like yourself at a busy centre, the more golf swing, good or bad, you see, the more you think and figure out, well, how am I going to improve this, help this lady or gent?
And are there lessons from your early days when you were starting out in your career? Are there any ones that you look back on and think, what was I thinking then? I really should give him a I need to phone him up and give him a refund.
Without a shadow of a doubt. Without a shadow of a doubt. And that still goes on. I think if you're a coach and you don't think, if you think you've learnt it all and you think you've got the formula for the to give the best lesson, well, think again, because it's ever changing and the student's ever changing, of course. But no, if I look back at some of the lessons I gave, you'd give your money back all day long. And you know that you're never going to hit it off with every person. It's like personalities. You know, if you met someone in the pub or whatever, you're not everybody's you're going to get on with. So you, even the best players in the world, and people will go to coaches, they say, oh, I went to Pete Cowan or I went to such and such and it didn't work for me, or I went to, you know, see Butch Harmon in America and paid $10,000 and he told me what you told me. And
you've got to be able to get your message across in many different ways. That's what I found. You know, one analogy isn't good enough for, you know, shallowing the shaft. You've got to have 10, 20, 30 of them.
You've got 100 tools in your toolbox, and the more tools you have in your toolbox, and you can't please everybody all the time, but although you're trying to, that's just the fact of life. It's impossible. And you know, for some people is more suited and others you're not. But you're trying your best. And I think it's, you know, when I talk to young coaches, as I did when I came to see you guys, you know, the students got to know you care about the game. And if you don't care about the game, I've never wanted to coach for the money. And I don't think any coach worth the salt is doing it for the money. They're doing it for the love of the game and the process. And they want to help that student get better. The byproduct is people give you money.
And so from when you've started then, obviously, you know, good career, taught thousands, you know, millions of lessons, and like you said there, with the exposure to the great coaches from across into America, worldwide, what do you see that's changed in your career, certainly, and definitely over the last 5-10 years? I think obviously the isolation now at the moment that we're going through has sort of exposed a lot more people to golf coaching, great coaches, as where it probably before was a bit of an elite club that you had to either pay thousands of dollars to go and see, you know, Butch Harmon or, you know, Mac O'Grady or whoever it would have been, but now it seems readily available to everyone.
Yeah, in the past, there's some pals of mine who are in the PGA coaching system and so on, and I set up these teaching conferences in the late 90s, so 20 years ago. I was conscious that pros weren't talking enough about coaching, so at the time when I was at Drive Time, we had a lovely function room, so I set up the North Region PGA coaching conferences, where I was very lucky to have support from Alan Thompson, Tommy Fleetwood's coach, and Alan's a great guy and taught so many good players from the Northwest and around the region. And Eddie Birch, the pro at Royal Lytham. But then latterly, John Jacobs and Dennis Pugh and Pete Cowan and all these guys came to speak. And it was great because we got all like-minded coaches conversing. Now, the world's such a small place that anybody, you know, beginner or novice or non-golfer, you can access all these podcasts and all the Instagram lives and so on. I think you've got to differentiate. You've got to be a little careful to differentiate what a coach wants and what a player needs. There are two completely different cultures.
So, yeah, there's a lot of people getting involved in numbers nowadays and data and coming in, you know, the average handicapper. And, you know, the majority of them are great, but you will get the odd sort of person who's really geeked themselves out and maybe going off down the wrong road.
I think the consumer, if we're not careful, I don't want to sound like a dinosaur, but the consumer can be a bit misled that all the technology and all the lovely swings you see on Instagram. So every swing I look at it on Instagram with certain coaches, you think, bah, that's a great looking golf swing. But those players are one of a million players. You know, the swings are as good as any tour player. But does that mean they can play golf? Does that mean they've got the temperament, the short game, the funds, the family life, the bio, social models? So if you listen to someone like Ian Peake, Ian's a PGA Master Professional in Germany, Ian, but Scottish guy, who's done a lot of research on the things that make up a tour player and why, say, certain Walker Cup players were great players and didn't make it on tour. We're getting into another realm there of elite players transitioning from tour. But going back to your thing about technology or your question about technology, is that there's never been, and it's going to be harder to have any more wealth of information about how we can measure stuff. So measuring stuff sheds light on sometimes, shall we say, a retrospective action. It's just happened that the ball's been hit and we knew that your arms did this and there was that much pressure going into the floor and the ball did this and the club face did that. That said, it still measures the same task that was happening 100 years ago. So when Bobby Jones was hitting a ball, you know, and then when Ben Hogan was hitting a ball, and then McIlgrady or anybody, or Tiger was today, or Rory McIlroy, the same physical thing is still happening. The players are fitter, the equipment's better, the ball's going further. But the actual mechanics of what's happening is no different. And in 1,000 years from now, it's not going to be any different. You've got to swing the club in the appropriate shape, the right shaped arc. You've got to control the path of the club. You've got to control the club face. You've got to control the angle of attack. You've got to center the strike. You've got to do it at speed, and you've got to do it repetitively. And those things, that's John Jacobs, you know, old cite his little saying, but that isn't ever going to change. All we now can do is shed light on what is actually happening. Does it make the task any easier? Well, the secret's kind of still in the dirt. You still, if you're any good, you're going to have to hit thousands of golf or millions of golf shots.
And do you think a lot of it now, what's changed, is almost become let's play golf swing as opposed to let's play golf? You know, my path is 0.0, and my low point was 2 inches after the golf ball, and I had X amount of loaded pressure in my backswing, instead of, well, what number did you get the golf ball around the course in today?
Yeah, golf is, you know, we can pontificate about it and so on. And there's a commercial thing driving these things along as well, because the launch monitor companies want to sell launch monitors, the biomechanical people want to sell their measuring equipment, and the data people want to sell their data programs. And so there's a balance between commercialism and help, if you like. And there's nothing wrong with that. And technology has, as I say, it's uncovered or validated, shall we say. It's validating what we kind of suspected went on in a golf swing. And now you can say, I thought that happened, but yeah, it does actually happen, and X, Y, Z. And, you know, and as Martin Hall says, they're good, but they're not God. They don't do everything. You know, there's a blend of art and science in golf, isn't there? And art and science and so on. But a lot of the, there is a maybe a pendulum swing where we're heavily into the science at the moment, whether it'll swing back more to the craft of learning to play golf. Because don't forget, as you just said, the bottom line, and I was chatting to Carl Morris about this yesterday, the bottom line is, and the cruel thing is, well, what did you shoot? Well, I did this, I didn't do that. Yeah,
yeah, just tell me the number.
What did you shoot? What did you score? So till the end of time, the best players are the people who get the little ball around the course. And
yeah, and it's almost the sort of badge of, what would you call it?
Honour.
Yeah, the badge of honour to have that scratch handicap, or you know, when you get someone that you may go on a golfing holiday, and you meet a few players that you've never met, and they, oh, what are you off? Well, I'm off scratch, and all of a sudden that person's put on a pedestal, and
yeah,
it's not, well, I swing 2 degrees and I load my pressure in a certain way. It all comes down to what we've scored, and you know what the handicap is for the amateur. And you know, are we losing sight of that sometimes?
Yeah, I think
too
there's a
much?
Balance again between swing vanity. You know, so if Matt Wolf came into your bay and you didn't know him, or if Jim Furyk came into your bay and you didn't know him, you know, and it was a great job. We always, you know, as coaches, we always cite Jim Furyk's father, who's a golf pro, for leaving him alone. That was, you know, most of us probably wouldn't have done that. We would have said, hang on a minute, you can't do that. Why didn't you do this? You know, but then he says, well, I've got $75 million in the bank that says this is actually okay. So it does take an experience, you know, coach not to sometimes, or when to know to leave something alone, or you could see from the ball flight or their repetition or their control that actually this guy or girl can play. So there are outliers now, fortunately, Bubba Watsons, people like that who break the mould. But the reality is, still getting back to John Jacobs, in the cold light of day, whether you're Jim Furyk or Matt Wolf or Bubba Watson or whether you're Adam Scott, the club is still, at the moment of truth, travelling on the right path, looking in the right direction, on the relevant angle of attack for that given shot. Because again, we get into this mystique. Everybody, you know, wants to say, oh, what about Mo Normal? Or what about Ben Hogan or McIlvaine? There's this mystique of this perfect machine-like golf swing. But the reality is, every golf shot is a snowflake. It's unique. And if you got Adam Scott's launch monitor numbers hitting 7 irons in a round of golf, not one of them would be the same, because what he's doing when he's hitting a ball to a pin at back left, his angle of attack, let's say he's drawing one into a pin at 185 yards back left, his angle of attack might be 4 degrees down, his launch angle might be 14 degrees, he might be 2 degrees out past to the right. And then if he's hitting a 7 iron 3 holes later to a pin that's front right at 170 yards, he might be launching at 16 degrees with two angles of attack and the path that's going left. So if he's hitting a fade or a draw, so
the shot dictates the motion.
Yeah, in real simple terms, you've got the three S's, as I call it. You've got to learn to strike the ball. So you need a repeatable golf swing. And that's where coaches like yourself and all the coaches out there, we're trying to help people develop a golf swing that gives them a modicum of control. So again, there's loads of talk about random practice, you've got to vary your practice. Well, that's great, assuming you possess a golf swing. You know, loads of people doing random practice on the range, they don't make two swings that look the same, and that's where they're no good. You hit one left, hit one right, military golf, you know. So there's loads of people practicing randomly, but they're just practicing rubbish. So you have to, going back to the secrets in the dirt and the Hogan and whatever, you've got to stand there and learn how to form the same grip consistently. Learn how to swing the club in a consistently half-decent arc. Learn how to put your feet in the right place.
Yeah, I think it's no secret that every tour player or any great player who's out there just spent hours trying different things, finding a swing, you know, how do I stop this chip shot a little bit quicker? How do I make this driver turn this way in the air? And, you know, it just comes down to time and repetition and talent and hard work.
Effort, self-discovery as well. And so you have to discover some of this yourself. You have to do something. That's actually always much more meaningful than some coach like you and me telling them what to do. Once the light comes on with a certain thing. And golf's fluid as well. You've got to understand that one morning you wake up and you feel you've got speed and you stand there and you hit the ball great and you think you might be playing on your own in an evening and you think, God, that's fantastic. I wish I could take that into the medal tomorrow or a tournament next week or what have you. Then the next day you wake up and your fingers feel fat and your body feels slow and you haven't got the speed. What the scientist, and again, I had a long conversation with another pro yesterday, sometimes what the scientist, there's a massive research, some very, very talented scientists, which you can again listen to podcasts in isolation, and their background is trying to find a model or unearthing the science, which we can't change. Science is laws of force of motion are fixed. They're trying to, shall we say, pigeonhole certain things that happen in a golf swing, which is fine. But the big caveat, if you like, is unfortunately there's a human on the end of the golf club, and the human changes daily in the way they feel and the way they operate and their moods and so on. So one day they're swinging it great, next day you're swinging it badly with exactly the same swing thoughts you had the day before, from the same theory.
So So for the average golfer listening now, what would be your sort of staple advice if there was three things you said to John Smith, who's walked in, just played a couple of rounds with his mates, been out on the driving range a few times, and just wants to get better? He's got some time on his hands, he's got a little bit of money. How do we get better at the game of golf?
Number one, if you can find yourself a good coach who's going to help you on that journey, fantastic. And it's a big, broad question, that, because, again, everybody's, what drives different people is different. Some people are range rats. They just love hitting balls on the range. They don't want to play golf. I've had consumers or lessons in the past that just love the challenge of hitting better golf shots. And if that's what turns them on, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I've got guys, you know, a lot of people love practicing. Now, some people hate practicing. Their attention span is limited. They want to compete. They just want to go out and beat the hell out of their mates, and so on. But in simple terms, you've got kind of three S's I mentioned before. You've got to learn to strike it. You've got to then learn to become a shot maker. And then you've got to learn to score. Use those other two S's to learn to become a scorer. Now, learning to score is about your emotions, yeah, your short game, your preparation, your in-round motivation or mood, should I say. You know, can you manage yourself on that golf course? Go on.
I actually tell a lot of my lessons, a story from when you were coaching me, when I was off about, I think, 3 or 2 handicap, and you said, it's all well and good, you can strike it great, but you can't play golf yet. And I was thinking, this guy's crazy. Like,
I can't swear. I'm
off 2 handicap and he's telling me I can't play golf. Yeah, I think there was a few choice words in there. But, you know, and you referred to this, the three S's model. He said, you can strike it, you can hit it, you know, far, you can do what you do, but you can't score. You know, you can't actually go out there, because I was a hothead on the golf course. He said, you know, got great action, strike it well, do everything well, but you get in your own way. So until you can learn to do that, you may as well swing it poorly, because it's just a waste of time. And then I sort of recant this to my lessons now that I went and got, you know, obviously got older, things in life changing now. Yeah, older, my hair fell out. And put on a few pounds, and you know, it doesn't really matter to me as much anymore. The sort of the score, I enjoy the social aspect, and my game's better because of it. Because I'm not in my own way. Because if I make one poor golf swing, thinking, well, you know, I've hit 1,000 golf balls, what's wrong? It's having the, I've got maybe not as good an action, but I've got more of the whole package now.
Question as well, so I kind of get led down a path. But golf may change after this. I don't know. You've got a very big spectrum where you've got people heavily in the technological science end at the moment, and then you've also got people in the neurological end. And you've got, say, a coach like Mike Hebron, who is one of the most knowledgeable coaches you could ever meet, from Smithtown Landing in New York. So what he didn't know about the golf swing wasn't worth knowing. Now, Mike has gone completely the opposite way now. He still has all that knowledge, but he's now, I don't know if he's actually a professor, but he's certainly a PhD in things like in the neuroscience and the way people learn. So the way people learn information or process skills and motor skills and so on, and everything in life, how we see the world, you know, that's where the pendulum is going to swing a little bit more, and the psychology of the game and so on. Now, that doesn't still give you a golf swing. You're still going to have some core principles. You're still going to have to swing the club on a respectable plane. You're still going to have to hold it correctly. You're still going to have to manage the club face. You're still going to have to do all those things. But there is this big spectrum at the moment, and the pendulum probably will swing back more, and it is doing it with people like Adam Young and so on, the practice manual, where learning different skills, learning to hit the ball on different parts of the face, a bit of random practice and trying different shots and so on. But there's so much we don't know about the way people process information or learn things. One thing's for sure, if you spent time with Martin Hall, Butch Harmon, John Jacobs, all these fantastic coaches, number one, they're great communicators. Mark's got supreme knowledge. What he doesn't know about the golf swing and all the different array of teaching methods and what coaches have taught over the years, because there's
There's probably a bias for being a better communicator than a coach. You'll probably get someone who's a fantastic coach, all the information in the world, but couldn't speak to anybody, is no use to anyone.
Players are like that, you know, and can't communicate what, say, they felt they were doing, you know. And if Martin or somebody told you everything you knew, you'd be there for 10 years, and it wouldn't help the student, because the trick is, you know, choosing the tools, should we say, off the toolbox of your out of your knowledge base for that appropriate student at the time. It's no different than going to see the doctor. The doctor might know everything about the human body, but he isn't going to tell you something irrelevant. He's not going to tell you about your toenails when your problem's with your heart. So he has to draw on his years or her years of information and knowledge and experience to then apply the right remedy. But I think consumers, unfortunately, possibly at the moment, are being a little bit, not misled. They're being sold the idea of a shortcut, that if you go on Instagram and do this and do that and do, you know, do the other, you're going to be a wonderful golfer. I mean, I've been to hundreds and hundreds of seminars. One of the ones with Clive Woodward years ago stuck in my mind, that he said it's not wrong to be obsessive. You know, we live in a world where people aren't, shall we say, allowed to be different or whatever. But he said, you know, most of the sports men and women he'd encountered were pretty obsessive. So if you're going to be good at something, whether it's tiddlywinks or golf, normally you have to have a bit of an
obsession. Yeah, you can't just dip your toe in the water and expect to be, you know, the greatest player out there. You know, certainly when I was playing and trying to get my handicap even down and down, like you say, for yourself as a kiddie. And you look at the juniors as well that you see at the golf club, and you see them winning the comps all the time. They just spend their lives there, round the chipping green, on the golf, you know, on the course, on the range, and everything is just golf. Then 18 comes and booze and girls.
Relatively, you know, by the time, you know, they're 12, 13, 14, 15, and they develop, with that sheer volume of golf and the school holidays, they'll end up shooting down from 15 handicap to 5 handicap in no time. Obviously, then getting from 5 down to, say, scratch, that's when the real hard yards are done. Because going back to yourself about learning to control your emotions, you know, there are tour players we know today. We can, you know, you can watch Sky TV and you can think of 2 or 3 tour players that, if they had a better temperament, may have won substantially more majors. Yeah. They could be the most supreme ball strikers on the planet.
But that maybe a Spanish potentially person, one Spanish per person.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. I mean, we're not there. We can't. These guys are super talented and super. And that's us outside looking in, you know. But then you get, you know, other Ryder Cup players or whatever. You think, oh, he was a kind of average player. And all of a sudden, they make themselves into great. And
great player, yeah, just to use their abilities to the best done. And get the most
and
out of it.
It's frustrating sometimes when you watch people who are great players and they've not managed to control their emotions, because you think, well, how much better could they be? But they're actually at the sharp end doing it, so it's easy for us to sit outside and criticise. I mean, you know, they can do it, we can't. And you know, those players that you know, take some nerve and some guts. And, you know, I asked John Jacobs once, what's the most important thing, you know, technique or temperament? He said temperament, and that's coming from the father of European golf.
God, you know, if you ask, godfather, you know, of
Amy
golf, Harman, yeah.
Anybody, David Ledbetter, who's the best coach, and obviously they all say Jacobs, justifiably, but temperament is equally as important at club level as well, because people get frustrated and throw clubs and bang things and blame everything. Well, no, you wouldn't do that.
Never
blame
done that.
Everybody but themselves. But, you know, golf, as Mark McCormack, I think, said, it is you against yourself. And that is the biggest the biggest challenge.
So where do we see golfing going then over the next 5-10 years? What's the trends going to be? What are the big, are there any more big breakthroughs? Obviously we've seen, and with no disrespect here, you've seen quite a lot of them, obviously, from, you know, the image of Dennis Pugh carrying that massive camera down a tour range to, you know, even the internet to now TrackMan, FlightScope, you know, GC Quad to pressure plates. You know, you've literally in the last 30 years we've seen some serious innovations, haven't we? So what's the next big thing, or do you think we've pretty much topped out on the science level, and where do we go from here?
I suppose that's never ending. I don't know. There's so much, as I say, measuring equipment out there now. It's fantastic. Listen, again, I think it was Mark Blackburn the other day said, you know, if you had, and this is a guy who's heavily into his tech and his force plates and so on, with the GASPs force plates and so on. And he said, well, if I had to go back and have one piece of equipment, what would I have? And he said, his iPhone. Because obviously visual pictures paint a picture in our mind. We all have a picture in our mind of how we think our swing looks. And whether you think you're imitating Rory or think you're imitating Tiger or whoever, obviously our swings don't look like that, but visually our senses, we learn by take a lot of information in through our eyes. We can take other stuff in intellectually, numbers and graphs and so on, and those graphs, again, used correctly with somebody with great knowledge, that science and graphs used sparingly and correctly will help.
Yeah, it's more for the coach's benefit to relay it back in an easy way for the
student, at a particular level at a particular time. But there's no one thing that helps everybody all of the time in golf. They've all come and go, oh, this is the secret. Well, there isn't the secret. You know, there's nothing that's good for everybody, and there's no one golf swing that's good for everybody all of the time, just like every golf tip. And it's poison. Some things are poison to one person. So if
used incorrectly, definitely.
Yeah, so what Ricky Fowler's feeling with the club behind him isn't the same as what Bubba Watson's feeling. So if you gave them both the same swing tip, one would destroy them and the other one may help them. The key is, as they call it, modern term now, is matchups, is getting your components all to match up. Again, what's the goal? To control the golf ball and to score better.
Get lower.
Yeah, and I think the pendulum kind of may swing a little bit back to the art and craft of learning to score.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you think we'll see a full role reversal where everyone will just get a little bit bogged down and go, do you know what? I've had enough of my numbers, this, everything, whatever it may be. I just want to score lower. You know, if you had an hour with a golfer, or let's say a day with a golfer, and he wanted to break 100, I don't think that full day would be spent on the range, Matt, would it? It would be, right, no. let's see some swings, let's get you on the course.
I think the coaching model, unfortunately, is driven, and again, I had a conversation about this the other day. If I won the lottery tomorrow, I wouldn't be doing as many half-hour lessons or hour lessons. I would be playing with my students a lot more, seeing how they behave on the golf course, and I would love to do that with every one of my students. I'd love to see them, because I know without even improving one bit of the golf swing, I could get them around 5 or 6 shots less just by saying, well, hit it down there, now just chip it over that and avoid this. So from course management, going back to learning to strike it, learning to be a shot maker, learning to score, a bit of course management would go a long way, you know, and help people. So you could end up, as we said, with a load of people who can actually rip it on the range and have perfect looking golf swings, but can't manage the golf ball around the golf course.
Yeah, there's no trees, no bunkers.
Again, the commercial model is such: driving ranges, practice grounds, time, effort. You know, if you're a member of a country club in the US and it's a couple of $100,000 to join, and you're used to paying $200 for a lesson or whatever in certain parts, well, then the pro might be able to spend some time with you doing that. So sometimes what's driving the market, is it product, is it the internet, is it, you know, time, money, effort, all those factors. But you got to understand, technology isn't going to go away. It's part of our lives. You know, you want electric windows in cars, you want an iPhone, you want a phone that does everything with the internet. So it'd be foolish to think that technology is going away. It's not going to. You just got to use it sparingly. And if you're on the practice range at a tour event on those that final day, that Wednesday, those measuring kits and different things there
have all gone.
Well, not gone, but they're dumbing them down, or they're looking at numbers, or they're thinking, right, let's get into play golf mode. So that,
yeah.
Now they're getting into the preparation that Finno and all those guys have done, the caddies,
yeah.
And this is where we're going to hit it. And the weather and the wind, you can't control the weather, you can't control the grass, you can't control, as I said, how you wake up in the morning. So when that gun goes at their tee time, they're just thinking, right, I've got to get that little ball around this golf course. And it's a battle, it's game on. And you hope you've prepared and you've done your swing work. And those players, some will have a window of a few weeks where they play well. Some players, like Nicklaus over the years, can just make it.
Just turn it on at the right time. And
yeah, they, you know, Nicklaus is, you know, he's my hero, obviously, and Tom Watson, people like that. But fantastic golf mind, could just get the job done. Was he the best swinger? Particularly,
nope.
No, he's powerful, obviously, and in his day, and so on. And but the game has changed. Going back to the game changed. It's a power game now at tour level.
Yeah.
You know, again, watching a podcast the other day or a seminar Zoom thing. Bill Harmon, Butch Harmon's brother, is a very knowledgeable coach, and they were talking with Ledbetter and Martin, all these guys about coaching. It was Brian Manzella, who it was, and as Bill said, and he puts a lot of good stuff on Facebook and things. You know. As much as we're obsessed with kind of what tour players are doing and all the technology, that represents like 0.01% of the populace. What about the other 99% of club players out there trying to get better and score better and enjoy golf? You know, so we are kind of drawn, all tour players and what they're doing is sexy, and we kind of get sucked into what they're doing because we all aspire to want to be great players, but there are all these different levels, aren't there? And what a club golfer needs is sometimes
isn't very, necessarily very, what the tour player
very
needs.
Different than what a tour player needs. We all club players want to hit it. Of course, we want to hit it further. There's not a person on the planet who doesn't want to hit it further. But we want to hit it in the fairway more often. We want to hit more
greens. Manage the ball better.
We want to chip it closer. We want to hole a few more putts. And incidentally, that kind of takes me on to another thing about expectation. Because we're watching great golf on television and the way it's edited, you're seeing people hit putts and hole everything, there is a little bit of a perception that amateur golfers think that tour players never hit poor shots.
I think that's why our course vlogs, you know, with myself, Rick, Pete, Carter, always dragged in quite an audience, and people are always asking for them because there's that relatability factor, you know, like you say there, when you watch Rory, Tiger, Brooks, whoever it may be, they're only really showing the top 20 guys in a tournament out of the 120, 140 that started that week. And funnily enough, those top 20 are holing putts, they're hitting it close because they're in the top 20 that week. So you do get that perception that they never miss a shot, they never miss a putt. Everything they do is perfect, as where when we started doing the course vlogs, it was like, oh, right, you know, you're professional and, you know, you can play the game to a good standard. But you hit it out of bounds, you duffed a chip, you know, you didn't hold that 3-footer, and there's that sort of relief factor where people think, oh, right, it is a tough game and mistakes do happen and people, you know, everyone is not perfect. And like you say, it's getting those sort of realities in check for the amateur golfer and seeing that we aren't, you know, thinking that everything the pros do is perfect every time.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt, I was just looking for something on my phone, and that goes at every level or every department, shall we say, of the game. So
it's like the putts hole stats.
Well,
isn't it
is. I just pulled that up there now. So, you know, at 7'10", that's PGA, that's US PGA Tour, the top players only hold 50% of them.
I thought they hold everyone.
Yeah. So at 10 feet, they're only holding 38%. So everybody thinks that when they see a pro at 6 foot or whatever, that they're holding everyone. Well, they're holding 65% at 6 foot, but at 7'10", they're only holding half of them. You know, And at 25 feet, only 10%. And the same goes to chipping. When you look at the number one player in the world, how far, how close do they chip it?
Proximity to the hole.
12 and 25 yards, it's about 8 or 10 feet. You know, it's not as close as people think. Now, don't get me wrong, the top players are extraordinary talented athletes.
Oh, yeah.
When you see that rich vein of thorn of the guys who are winning each week, they're at the top of their game, and those stats are impressive. But they're ordinary people doing extraordinary things, and they've played golf all their lives. That is their job. They're hitting balls, they're athletic, you know, they're good, and they don't play well all the time, if you ask them. It's humanly impossible. So I think the consumers, or the students, and your amateur golfers, you call them consumer, sometimes impression or expectations, they want to hit perfect shots all the time and hole putts all the time. And again, this is back to patience and temperament and thinking, okay, sit tight, get it on the green, hit it on the fairway, hit it on the green. You know, it's a bit like the old...
Yeah, it's an 18-hole game and ride it out.
Playing golf with no pins. If you imagine you were just hitting it onto the green with no pins and all the strategies that, you know, and there is a bit of a pendulum swing with the, as I said, with the likes of, say, Carl Morris and Gary Nichols, but the lost art of playing golf. And all the, you know, Bob Rotella stuff, and this helped many major champions, you know, Harrington and people like that. Is that I'm not saying that part of the game is neglected, because I've done psychology stuff with Carl for over 20 years. We've kind of run workshops for my players, because I knew no matter how good I could help people swing the golf club, most people need help managing their brain and their emotions, and I'm certainly one of them. That was for me one of the big challenges. You're going back to your initial question about playing golf. Although I could kind of understand the intricacies of the golf swing and kind of swing it and control the ball quite well, controlling my nerves and my nerves, really, that was the hardest challenge for me.
Yeah.
Not the actual golf swing. The golf swing less difficult for me.
Getting yourself in check.
Yeah, well, I handled my nerves. Even to this day, when I played the seniors championship last year, and my heart started going, and I thought, I'm in unknown territory.
That's just because you're unfit.
Well, that's as well too. but learning to control your nerves, and that could be the lady or gent playing in the lady captain's prize or the gents captain's prize or a major at the club. Why is it on the Friday night before the major you hit it great and then you go in the comp and shoot 90, whatever? That might not be because your golf swing's fallen apart, it might be because you're not handling your emotions. So the first place in golf, it's always very easy to say, well, what's wrong?
Yeah,
what's wrong? You know, it's easy for a golf course, someone comes in, well, what's wrong, what do we want to put right?
Yeah, you can't see what they're thinking.
No, sometimes they've got a lot of things right and you just need to tweak it or improve it. We kind of live in a culture sometimes where, well, what's wrong and how can I fix it? Rather than maybe, well, how can I improve it? Or actually, there's nothing wrong. And then again, it takes an experienced teacher sometimes to leave somebody alone. I get players and I say, actually, you're swinging it pretty good. We're not going to do a lot today or change a lot, or let's look at your chipping or your putting. Because actually, you're swinging it, we don't need to fix this. Yeah. It ain't broken.
Yeah, just believe in yourself. So, almost, it's sometimes just like a bit of a confidence boosting lesson.
Yeah, I think, and again, in the old days, you see, before, you got to understand the way the game evolved. In the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, there were no video cameras, so players learned to play.
Yes.
So if you look at the Ryder Cup team, there was 12 different golf swings, but they were all good at getting the ball in the hole.
Yeah, just figured out what worked for them and got the job done.
Yeah, and that's also where in the States you see more of these outliers, because they go and play in a college team. They're not interested in how your swing looks. They're interested in, did the team win? How's the team performing?
Yeah.
So that's where players like Bubba and Matt Wolf can flourish, because they're not being, it's not swing vanity.
No,
they're
not just get the job done.
Good does your swing look? Is this guy a good guy? This guy's a great player. He gets it.
Yeah, he wins.
Or whatever. And I think that's where it's different in the States, and it is why there are potentially more, probably better looking swings on the European tour than there may be on the US tour.
Mm.
Because of the college system, that golf is about scoring and winning in their world.
Yeah, very, very, very good. Well, we're nearing that hour mark now, so we're going to wrap it up here. Got three quick fire questions for you, though, before I let you go on about your day. So, past or present, if you got a lesson from one coach, who would it be?
Well, I have been lucky enough to have it, and obviously it'd be foolish of me to not to say, and this is no disrespect to all the other great coaches, but John Jacobs.
Okay.
But I'm lucky enough that he did savage me.
Best book or podcast for an average golfer to help them improve?
Oh, now that's a difficult one. And again, a seminar, they asked that same question the other day. And this sounds like getting biased again, but something like Practical Golf is a great book for
John Jacobs, that one.
John Jacobs, yeah. But podcasts, I would certainly have a listen to Carl Morris, The Brain Booster, mm-hmm. because, again, he talks to some great technical coaches and whatever, but he's also leaning you towards, well, how do we learn? How do we get the job done? How do I best process my game and manage my game?
Okay, and so, third and final, your favourite golf swing of all time?
Oh.
Mine, obviously.
Yours, my own, of course. Because I wish, yeah, no, I hate my. I don't know. I've not particularly got big favourites. At the time, I was a big Tom Watson fan. I saw him at the Open in '77, and that, you know, and that was when he won the Duel in the Sun with Nicklaus. So he was my big. I would have loved to have seen Peter Thomson play from an efficiency, because Peter Thomson just saw the game so simply. Well, what's the problem? You just hit the ball down there with this swing. So, if he's going on Instagram, just so simple.
Watson or Peter Thomson, pick one.
Peter Thomson or Tom Watson, you know. Tom Watson's swing evolved. Tom Watson's swing evolved. His golf swing more today is more of what we'd class as... A more modern
swing. Excellent. Well, thank you for your time today. Some great, great little nuggets of wisdom there from you. Obviously, spent a lot of time coaching, and hopefully the listeners are going to be able to take something from this and improve themselves. If people want to go and follow you or contact you, where should they find you?
You can find me, obviously, on my website, at solidgolf.co.uk, or Adrian at solidgolf, or...
And Insta, Twitter, are you on those?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, Solid Golf, and Instagram, Solid Golf, and also at liverpoolgolfcentre.co.uk, obviously.
Excellent. Well, thank you for your time today. Keep yourself busy, and hopefully we'll be back on the fairway soon.
Yeah, no, thanks, and good luck to everybody. And as my pal, and again, it's more relevant than ever, David Edwards, the Trick Shot Man Golf, an acronym for... Great opportunity for lifelong friendship, and I think we appreciate that more than ever now, that it's just going to be great to get back out playing with our buddies and not beating ourselves up too much. And
true, cherish it. Excellent. Well, see you soon. Thanks for calling. Well, there we go, guys. We have the first episode of the Coach's Corner all done for you. That was some great information from there, from Adrian. I think the three S's model that he talked about, learning to strike it, learning to shape it, and learning to score, is a great way for anyone to approach the game. If you can get those three things in place and start to really evolve those skills and master those skills, we should start to see that we're playing better golf. Lots of things in there as well about the launch monitor and the state of golf and where we think the new trends are going to come and what's going to happen, but loads of things for you to pick in there. So I hope you've enjoyed this first episode of the Coach's Corner podcast. If you have, do remember to comment and rate the podcast. Also share it with a friend, maybe. Let them try and discover a way to help them get better at golf. We've got plenty more guests coming up, and hopefully the next episode, well, not hopefully, it will be out next week for you. So stay tuned, stay safe out there, and enjoy your golf. I've been your host, Matt Fryer, and I'll see you in the next podcast.